This book, The Maintenance of Headway, is about buses and bus drivers. I don't know if anybody catches the 390 that comes down Gower Street. Well, I drive it. So beware. When I finished writing my first book and had a bit of success with it, I thought that I would just stop working and just be a full-time writer. But being a full-time writer wasn't quite what I wanted, so I do both now. Right, I'm going to start off. I'm just going to read some excerpts because I don't want to give the plot away. Is that all right, Sam? And this starts with a conversation between some bus drivers in the canteen, sitting around the table, discussing the chaos that is the bus service. And it starts with a character called Edward, who's a sort of sage-like character. "The fact is," said Edward, "it's almost impossible to run a proper bus service in this city. The obstacles ranged against success are just too numerous. Oh, I know there are cities on the continent where buses are a byword for efficiency, and people wonder why it can't happen here. But those places are bland and featureless. Mostly they were bombed flat and rebuilt from scratch. The roads are spacious and the populations obedient, rational and unselfish. Buses sweep along, keeping exactly the schedule, punctual at every point from start to finish. In this city, it's different. The streets are higgledy-piggledy and narrow. There are countless squares and circuses, zebra crossings and pelicans. Go east from the arch and you've got 23 sets of traffic lights in a row. All those shops and all those pedestrians pouring into the road. Then there are the daily incidentals, street markets, burst water mains, leaking gas pipes, diesel spillages, resurfacing works, ad hoc refuse collections, broken down vehicles, troops on horseback, guards being changed, protest marches, royal cavalcades and presidential motorcades. Shall I go on?" "You might as well," I said, "now you've started." "The men who dig up the roads don't care about the people on the buses, nor do the cabbies, the dairymen, the delivery men, the road sweepers, the wheel clampers, the rickshaw peddlers, the out-of-town coach drivers, the sightseeing operators, and the host of others who conspire to clog up the bus routes. Consequently, a journey that can be completed in an hour on Tuesday may take an hour and a quarter on Wednesday and an hour and a half on Thursday. This puts the Board of Transport in a very difficult position. On the one hand, they're obliged to provide sufficient running time to allow for all these contingencies. But then on the days when nothing happens and the roads are clear, they end up stuck with a succession of early buses. Faced with this dilemma, they've adopted a single guiding principle from which they will not stray, whatever the circumstances." Edward paused. I'd heard him deliver large parts of this speech before, but it was always interesting to hear his variation on a theme. "The bit about the presidential motorcades, for instance, was a recent addition. Normally referred only to prime ministerial motorcades." Jeff, who was sitting opposite Edward, appeared suitably impressed. He'd only been with us a few months, and it was obvious he hadn't heard Edward in full flow before. "What is this guiding principle?" he asked. "The maintenance of headway," replied Edward. "The notion that a fixed interval between buses on a regular service can be attained and adhered to." "But that's preposterous." "Preposterous or not," said Edward, "the maintenance of headway is held up as the one great truth by the Board of Transport. All the officials are indoctrinated with the central tenet." And that's the title of the book, ladies and gentlemen. Now, don't forget, I'm writing this from the bus driver's point of view, and one of the things that bus drivers tend to do is run early, although the public would never believe this. So I want to try to explain the theory of early running. The theory of early running comprised a few basic laws which any bus driver should have known. The first law stated that the closer a bus was to the preceding bus, the fewer the people it was likely to pick up. The second law stated that the earlier bus was running, the more easily it could avoid being late. The third law functioned in a negative. It stated that if a bus was running late, the number of people waiting for it would increase exponentially. The theory of early running was self-evident. It could be proved by mathematical induction. Yet some drivers never put it to the test. Instead, they endeavoured to run exactly on schedule, and as a result, carried more than their fair share of passengers. Then, at the end of the day, when they finished work late, they failed to claim the overtime. The reason they gave was that they didn't want to be any trouble to the bus company. I tried to explain that the company preferred them to claim the overtime because it showed they hadn't been early. But they wouldn't listen to me. They just continued making life difficult for themselves. Now, there's a driver called Jason who does his own thing, basically. And I'm going to talk about this character called Jason. He had what might be called an offensive approach to other road users. He would use his bus to bully smaller vehicles into submission. And he had no patience whatsoever with bicycles. He once abandoned the bus to give chase to a cyclist who jumped a red light and caused him to brake hard. The cyclist could count himself very lucky he wasn't caught. He only escaped because Jason was on foot. Shortly after the incident, I asked Jason if he regretted his action. "Of course I regret it," he replied. "I should have run the cunt over while I had the chance." Naturally, Jason practiced the theory of early running, though I doubt if he ever considered its subtleties. These were numerous and varied. In my experience, it was important to apply the theory selectively according to specific circumstances. Such concerns held no concern for Jason. By contrast, he operated under a shadowy fourth law. This stated that a bus running very early was impossible to catch and therefore might just as well not run at all. Jason was, in short, a serial early runner. That is to say, he ran early whenever it was physically possible to do so. His complete disregard for the schedules was well known. This is another dilemma faced by bus drivers. Jeff and I were sitting in the canteen one day when Davey joined us. "You know what never ceases to amaze me?" he asked. "No," I replied, "do tell us." "What never ceases to amaze me is how people can stand at a bus stop watching you come down the road and then not put their hands out." "Oh yes," I said, "you have mentioned it before." "On 320 previous occasions, actually." "Unbelievable," said Davey. "Some of these people depend on the buses as their only means of transport, yet they persistently refuse to give the appropriate signal." "Which stop are we talking about?" inquired Jeff. "You know the one after you leave the Ring Road by the National Archive?" "Yeah," said Jeff. "Request stop." "Precisely," said Jeff. "It's a request stop. And 30 of them stood there gawping at me as I drove up. Not one person moved a muscle." "So you didn't stop then?" "Of course I didn't stop," Dave explained. "I usually get shot at the end of these sessions." "Nobody requested me." "What if they complain?" asked Jeff. "They won't." "How do you know?" "Look," said Dave, "if people are too lazy to stick their hand out, they're hardly going to bother writing a letter of complaint, are they? They might phone up." "Verbal complaints aren't accepted," Dave rejoined. "Besides which, there's no case to answer." "You took the proper course of action," I said. "If you'd stopped, you would have set a very awkward precedent." "They'd start taking it for granted." "It's perfectly clear," Davey announced. "A request stop means exactly what it says." He stood up and demonstrated. "To catch a bus at a request stop, people are supposed to stand adjacent to the curb and put their hands out at right angles," he said, "like this." "Not this," he poked out one finger. "Nor this. Nor this. Not even this." He turned his back and waved his arm. "That's the one I just did." "Only this." He faced us again and held his arm out straight. "An arm extended in full view of the bus is the only acceptable signal," he concluded, before finally sitting down. During Davy's brief lecture, Edward had come into the canteen. "What about compulsory stops?" he said. "Do you always serve them?" "Of course," Davy answered. "I stop even when they don't put their hands out." "What if the stop is empty?" "In that case, I don't bother." "Well, strictly speaking, you're supposed to halt and apply the handbrake." "But that's preposterous," exclaimed Jeff. "Preposterous or not," Edward replied, "the rule book says compulsory stops should be honoured at all times, even when empty." give me a moment, please. This is a brief conversation between two bus drivers standing by their buses in King's Cross. It was mid-morning, we were parked up the cross, standing by our buses and drinking tea from paper cups. Jason was in his usual belligerent mood. "Guess what this cunt said to me just now?" "Which cunt?" I replied. "This fireman." "Don't know. He said I was driving too fast." "Blimey, fucking cheek, I'll say. He told me I should only be going at walking speed." "Was he in his fire engine?" "No," said Jason, "he was up a ladder." And there's another thing that I had to draw to. The question of when and where a bus should stop. Are we doing right for time? The question of when and where a bus should stop was a thorny one. Apart from the abstract distinction between request and compulsory stops, there was also the matter of so-called runners. Obviously, if a driver waited a bus stop to allow people to catch up, it was widely considered to be a good deed. Sometimes the people even said thank you. It was also a useful ploy if the bus happened to be excessively early and the driver was looking for an excuse to pause somewhere. Confusion arose, however, when prospective passengers attempted to race a moving bus to an empty bus stop. There was nothing more irritating to a bus driver than to be cruising along in a leisurely manner towards an apparently deserted bus stop, only for one of these runners to come galloping into view, running along as though their whole life depended on it. Runners were divided into two subcategories, logical and illogical. Logical runners ran in the same direction as the bus. They were Illogical runners were the ones who had given up waiting for the bus and begun walking towards the next bus stop. Then, when they suddenly heard the bus approaching, they came running back. It made no sense whatsoever to run away from their final destination, yet many people did this quite regularly. In both cases, the physical definition of a bus stop was crucial. It usually consisted of an upright pole with a sign attached bearing the words, "Bus Stop." This could be augmented by a large rectangle painted on the surface of the road. In some cases, there would be a bus shelter. In the absence of bus shelters, people were also known to gather under a nearby tree or beneath the awning of a shop. Because of these various aspects, the precise location of any bus stop was open to interpretation. In general terms, however, it was the upright pole that seemed to count for most. Runners always assumed that if they got to the pole first and touched it, then the bus would be obliged to stop. This was known in bus parlance as the race for the poles. In the era of the platform bus, of course, there was plenty of scope for compromise. Drivers could slow down and allow the more athletic runners to leap aboard without bringing the bus to complete halt. In the past, conductors could often be seen standing on their platforms, offering verbal encouragement to each valiant individual as they ran along behind the bus. Having a go was considered highly dangerous and officially frowned upon. Without doubt, it contributed to the demise of the open platform. Nevertheless, it was a common practice for years and led to the expression, catching a bus. This itself was a misnomer. People only caught buses if the driver allowed it to happen. Jason, it goes without saying, had very strong views on the subject. Indeed, any mention of catching a bus tended particularly to rankle him. The way people would talk, you'd think they were big game hunters stalking tigers through the jungle, he said, or out in the ocean reeling in swordfish and marlin. "Ooh, I had a struggle catching the bus this morning. For fuck's sake, it's pathetic. There's a fucking bus every 8 minutes. What's so challenging about that?" "Maybe it seems different from where they are," I suggested. "Huh," said Jason. Personally, I tried to maintain a balanced outlook. But at times it could be difficult. After all, it was much easier to keep going than to stop. Sometimes a kindly act could even backfire. Once I waited a whole minute at a bus stop for a man who was running desperately through the early morning gloom. Only when he ran straight past me and continued up the road did I realise he was a jogger. In the final analysis, the question of runners was a matter of discretion. As a point of reference, the rule book stated that we were supposed to wait for all intending passengers. Jason's verdict was different. People wait for buses, he said. Buses don't wait for people. Thank you.